Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Thursday, August 13th. I'm Ray Graff. It's Astronomy Today, and a lot to talk about. We welcome back Dr. Valerie Rapson, Assistant Professor of Physics and Astronomy at SUNY Oneonta. And joining Dr. Rapson today, once again, is Julia Busmeyer, a Senior Physics and Astronomy student at SUNY Oneonta. If space fascinates you, this is going to be a great show. We had the solar eclipse yesterday, the Perseids, are in progress. Yeah, I hear, you know, mixed reviews on what people can see so far. We have a lunar eclipse coming up at the end of the month. A new globular cluster in a far-off galaxy is shedding light on dark matter. All that to talk about. Give us a call, 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Back after the news. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. It's Astronomy Today, and we welcome back Dr. Valerie Rapson, an assistant professor of physics and astronomy at SUNY Oneonta. Valerie earned her Ph.D. in astrophysical science and technology at RIT. Joining Dr. Rapson today, she's becoming a regular, Julia Busmeyer, a senior physics and astronomy student at SUNY Oneonta. Julia also serves as president of STEM-Powered, a group dedicated to supporting women in STEM. You have a question about space, the final frontier? Give us a call, 800-348-2551. So much going on. 1-800-348-2551. You can also email us at voxpop@wamc.org. Voxpop@wamc.org for the email, or 800-348-2551. Dr. Valerie Rapson, how are you? How's summer been?
Doing good. It's going by way too fast. Classes start in a little over a week, and I'm like ready, but not ready.
Yeah.
It's flying.
What do you do to prepare for that first day of class?
Well, you know, we got to do the boring stuff, like put our syllabi together. But I try and come up with creative ways to, like, get the students excited, because I don't want to just stand there and read a document to them for 45 minutes. I want to be like, this is what you're going to learn in astronomy, and let's get all excited for all these fun things. So that's what I've been working on, is the first day activities.
But it's not your first rodeo. Can't you use the same syllabus as last year?
Well, mostly, yes. But, you know, the students change and I change, and I want to keep it fresh. You know, it gets real boring if I'm teaching exactly the same content. And plus, astronomy is changing all the time, so I've got to update the slides and put all the new discoveries in there.
I think about just that. The astronomy course I took up at Plattsburgh in the early 80s. So much has changed in that amount of time.
Right.
It's insane.
Mm-hmm.
Also with us today, Julia Busmeyer. This is your third or fourth time on the show.
My third time, yeah.
Well, it's very exciting to have you back. How's your summer been?
It's been good. It's also been going by quickly, but I'm ready to start my last year.
Your last year! And so you're taking it easy now. You're taking simple courses, right? And you're just going to relax, kick back, and do next to nothing, right?
As much as I can.
Wait a minute. You're not supposed to say that.
She's got a cool astronomy project she's going to do with me. You want to tell them about
What's
it?
That?
Yeah, so we are going to, we have a few spectrographs on campus that haven't been used in a few years. So we're going to try to get those back up and working and use them to take some atmospheric spectra for planets in the solar system.
All right, now for those listening who don't know what a spectrograph is, explain it for us a little bit.
Basically, it's this instrument that we put on our telescope. It connects to our camera also. And when light comes through it, it splits into a spectrum.
Yeah.
So we can, you know, pick out different chemical compounds.
And how far away? I mean, I always, my mind is constantly blown by things in astronomy. But how far away? I mean, these planets, you can't see them, really. How can you measure light and the qualities and the spectra of these planets from so far away?
Well, some will definitely be easier than others, like Jupiter and Venus. Those are super bright. We'll be able to get those no problem.
Oh, I thought you were outside of the solar system.
Not for this project.
Ah,
this project, well, we'll see.
if we can do a good job with the solar system, then maybe we'll try exoplanets. But I think that's a bit beyond what we're capable of.
You know, I heard, I don't know if it was on a show I was doing or what, but the scientist who discovered this, the spectrum, who was it? Do we remember who it was? And he saw, oh, God, was one of the big time.
Was it Newton?
I want to say it was.
I'm so bad with all of these little historical facts of like dates and who did what. But yeah, one of the famous people, you know, kind of noticed that as things came through the window, that the light broke into the rainbow, and they kind of put it together that this optical design could be created to split the light. And yeah.
When you were looking at the spectra from different planets, what are you specifically looking for?
Well, for this project, we have a, like, we pretty much know what to be looking for for the composition of the atmospheres. So we'll have to look at like what wavelengths, you know, they're emitting at the most and pick out different elements and stuff. Venus will be looking for like carbon dioxide.
Venus is so tough to see visually because it's just so bright and so cloudy. So I suspect that you would get more information by looking at the spectrum from that. What about some of the moons, the larger moons of some of these planets? Don't they have atmospheres as well?
Some of them have really thin atmospheres. Those would be harder to detect because we're really relying on the brighter targets for our telescope. Because when you take all of that light and send it through a spectrograph, all of the light that you would see with your eyes is now spread over the whole rainbow. So it's each little color, each little wavelength is a tiny bit of light. So we can do it for planets like Jupiter and Mars that are really bright. But when you're starting to go towards those moons, you need a pretty big telescope to see them accurately.
It's Astronomy Today with Valerie Rapson and student Julia Busmeyer today, 800-348-2551. Before we get to some of the big news that has been going on, one more thing on the spectrograph. You know, you think about a prism, right? And that's sort of how they started this.
Yeah.
What is a current state-of-the-art spectrograph look like, and how does it work?
Yeah, so prisms will just break up the light real simply, but nowadays we use gratings, which are basically microscopic triangular grooves, like cuts on this piece of glass. And what that does is it allows you to split the light at a very specific angle and get, you know, whatever resolution you accurately want. You're not relying on just the angle of the prism. So that's what we use, and the size and how finely the little sawtooth marks are, that governs what you can see and how good your spectrograph is. So most of them are like that today.
So you've dusted off a few and you're going to put them back into operation. What do you hope to find with this project?
Well, we hope to prove that we can actually do this and see strong enough signals from some of those brighter lines. And, you know, if this works really well, we could measure the strength of these lines and maybe look for changes long term. You know, we're not expecting to find any new elements that nobody's seen in Mars's atmosphere or anything like that.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's not necessarily continuous monitoring of some of these targets. And we can just see if small telescopes are capable of doing this and to what level.
That's pretty exciting. Valerie Rapson's our guest. Also, Julia Busmeyer. The number is 800-348-2551. Email is voxpop@wamc.org. If you have an astronomy question. So we had the solar eclipse yesterday.
Yes.
And I was doing the show, and we have cable news on, and they showed it live. Even on TV, it's spectacular to see.
Yeah, it really is. I was at work yesterday, and we set up the little C-Star automatic telescope, and any tours of students that came by, I totally hijacked them, and I was like, okay, 2 minutes, you're going to look at this eclipse, and everyone was so excited, and even though we only had like 10% of the sun covered up for us, it was still really neat to see.
Oh, you could see... I think it was cloudy here, although I was on the air.
Yeah, it cleared up for us.
Really?
Yeah. It was a little hazy, so it wasn't perfect, but we were out for most of it, and we could definitely see it.
All right. Now, you know, you didn't know anything about this because you only follow real stuff. Gravity was supposed to disappear yesterday.
Oh, was it?
I know Julia's heard about this on the internet, and thankfully gravity did not disappear. It was one of those internet things that goes out of control, and I think NASA yesterday actually had to put out a statement saying, don't worry, you're not going to rise 62 feet in the air, and everything's fine. The buildings are not going to come crashing down.
I didn't feel anything. Did you feel anything, Julia?
Not that I noticed. I was at the dentist.
Could you imagine if you got lifted out of the dentist chair?
That would not be good. I don't care how much Novocaine you get. That would not be good. So, Valerie, you told me that there is a new space telescope going up.
Yeah, the Nancy Grace Roman Telescope is getting launched, hopefully August 30th. You know, these things are always to be determined,
right.
But that's the plan. And it's super cool because the optics of the telescope are the same size as Hubble. It's a 2.4 meter, so it's big. But the way they've designed the optics is to make this telescope a much wider field of view. So one picture from Roman is equivalent to 100 Hubble pictures of equal quality at the same time.
That's
so we'll be able to survey like so much more, so much faster, but at the same quality as the Hubble
telescope. Well, let's hope they have all the settings correct before they launch it.
I hope so. It's another one that's going out where James Webb is going, so there's no way to fix it if there's any problems. So knock on wood, everybody. Let's hope that everything was tested.
Were you even alive when the Hubble went up?
I was alive. Barely. Yeah,
that was
a couple years old.
Whoever did that calculation, what happened? They didn't carry a decimal or something when they were grinding the lens?
They ground it perfectly to slightly the wrong shape. They ground it down too far, so it didn't bring the light to a focus in the same spot depending on where it hit. So they just basically built it a pair of glasses to fix it. They added some optics that kind of counteracted the curvature, and they were able to fix it, but it was a big oops for sure.
Well, you know, all's well that ends well, and it's been in great service for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
Perseid meteors, it's usually a blah.
Yeah.
People get excited, and people are talking about it in the newsroom. Every year, I see a few, but I never see that meteor storm, you know?
People were excited this year because it's new moon right now, so it's particularly dark, which means you might see more of the meteors. I don't know. I mean, I don't mind going outside for like 5 or 10 minutes and looking, but they don't excite me as much as others.
Yeah.
It's just, you know, it's a bunch of little dust coming through the atmosphere. Hopefully there's no big ones.
You're such
but
a jaded astronomer. Oh, Julia, what about you? You're young.
Well, I didn't get to go out last night. It was cloudy, although I was thinking about it. I went out. I tried to see it a few years ago, I think 2 years ago. And yeah, I mean, you know, you always expect it there to be kind of more.
Yeah.
Like a higher frequency. Yeah. But 2 years ago, I went out with my friends and we did see one that was so bright.
Isn't that amazing?
Cool. Incredible. And it was one of those ones where I just saw it like out of the corner of my eye and it was bright enough where I like turned to look at it. It was amazing.
Nice.
Those are incredible. And I know we've talked about it on this show before, but one of the biggest, I guess it was probably a bolide I ever saw when I was a kid. We were out on the back deck with my father, my brother and I, and there was a fizzing sound, which is not physically possible, right? Because, you know, concurrent with seeing it, you're not going to.
Yeah, the sound doesn't travel at the same speed. So
we
if you
all
hear
heard
a
it.
Fizz.
We all heard it. And it was definitely a meteor because they saw it up and down. I mean, from Maine and everything else.
Yeah.
You know, unless there's something in the electromagnetic spectrum that it is something in the ionization and we're picking that up at the speed of light.
I don't know.
It's true, though.
I believe you, but I've never heard anything like that before. So,
all right. Yeah. Well, let's take a quick break here, and then we'll get to the phones. And we have many more things to talk about, but we'll see. You know, we'll play it by ear. 800-348-2551 is the number. Email is voxpop@wamc.org. Astronomy with Valerie Rapson and Julia Busmeyer. We'll be back. Todd Nelson there. Dog leg panhandle is the... No, I got the name wrong. Oh, that's paper machete. I'm sorry. That's my bad. 800-348-2551. Todd Nelson, one of the greats from our region here and has been in the rock scene and the jazzy kind of scene for a long time. It's astronomy today with Valerie Rapson from SUNY Oneonta and SUNY Oneonta Senior preparing to relax for her final year, Julia Busmeyer. One email and then we'll jump to the phones, 800-348-2551. John writes in, I know people say that the faster you move through space, the more time slows down for you. They also say that the universe is constantly expanding. So what actually is movement if everything else is movement too? It's not like there's a grid of mile markers out there or anything. If the universe is constantly expanding and everything in it is moving, then what does it mean to be traveling at all? Even if you're moving at any speed, couldn't you just say that you're standing still while everything else is moving? And that's from John.
Yeah, that's
good luck, my friends.
That's like a deep question, right? I think the answer is, like, it's as tricky as the emailer is saying, because, you know, we're all moving right now, but do you feel like you're moving?
Well, sometimes.
I don't feel like I'm. Yeah, yeah, true. But, you know, we are moving, but it's all really about perception, right?
Yeah.
What are we seeing? Yeah. So we know, because we can observe things, that we're moving around the sun and that the galaxies are moving, but that's really space that's stretching. And if we physically do move, like with a spacecraft, we can travel, and that's going to manipulate time. And what it's really proving is that space and time are linked. So when time slows down, it's really because we're manipulating space. And vice versa. As we travel through it, we are changing time with us, and it all depends on your perception. Are you the one moving, or are you the one watching somebody move? So
relativity is interesting. Now, mm-hmm. do you, as someone who has a PhD, does it feel intuitive to you?
No.
Because it doesn't feel intuitive to me.
No, that kind of math was never my specialty. I find it absolutely fascinating. And I sat through a couple of courses on cosmology and relativity, and the math very quickly went over my head. But what it means to its core, like that time dilation and length contraction and stuff, like that is just fascinating. And I can't believe that we figured that out and are trying to apply that now to the whole universe. It's really cool, but way beyond what I think I'm mathematically capable of.
Dr. Valerie Rapson is with us, and student Julia Busmeyer. Julia, how are your math skills?
You know, pretty good.
Yeah.
When it comes to relativity, honestly, it makes more sense to me without the math.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Explain. Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, I guess I'm thinking specifically of like time dilation.
Yeah.
I was always kind of able to like make it make sense in my head conceptually. But then last fall, I took like the like intro to relativity class, and we're doing the math. And I like it's not like hard math necessarily, like objectively, but it's hard to wrap it into your understanding
so
of the concept.
Do you think Einstein came up with the concept first, or was working the math before he came up with the concept of relativity?
I don't know. I mean, I'm sure there's an answer to that somewhere, but
I don't know.
I couldn't tell you anything about his thought process.
Yeah, I feel like the concept has to come first, because mm-hmm. I feel like all of the craziest mathematical ideas are somebody making an observation or just thinking about, you know, what if this happened or that happened, and then somebody ultimately figures out the math, but I don't really know.
So interesting. I tell you what, they stole his brain for a time, mm-hmm. and it's probably somebody really wanted to know how you could be that
right?
smart.
Oh,
it's crazy. God. Let's go to Craig and Chatham. Craig, you're on. Go ahead.
Hi. It's my understanding that about a week or so ago, SpaceX or somebody shot a rocket at the moon to purposely crash land it. I was wondering, A, which might be a rhetorical question, why? And B, what kind of change in orbit or whatever might that affect, or whatever, you know, might actually be affected by doing such a thing?
All right, fair questions. Go ahead, Valerie.
Yeah, no, that's a great question. So, excuse me, they didn't actually shoot the moon on purpose. This was like a piece of a SpaceX rocket that was accidentally put in orbit around the Earth and moon, and it just so happened to crash land on the moon. So it wasn't done on purpose. And it did leave a cool crater, though. We've seen some satellite images since then of the small crater that it left behind, and it did disrupt a bunch of material, and now we can study that spot to see what's underneath the surface layer there.
Yeah.
So we can do some cool science with it, but it didn't affect the moon's orbit, and it wasn't done purposefully.
Craig, thanks a lot. Did anybody do any seismological testing on this? Because you remember back in Apollo, somebody dropped something and fairly heavy, and the moon allegedly rang like a bell for X number of hours.
Yeah, that's
did they
a
do
good
that this
question.
Time?
Well, the seismometers from Apollo, I don't believe, are functioning anymore, and I don't know if like the Chinese rovers that are there right now have that ability. I would have to check. You know, if they were close enough, it's possible that they felt it. But I'm not sure if we have any functional seismometers up there now.
Did anybody capture the plume from when it hit?
So I'm laughing because we talked about this before, about how AI made a beautiful video of it supposedly, but it's totally fake.
Yeah.
So everybody tried, right? Because we were supposedly able to see it like just barely at the edge with our telescopes. But so many people I know saw, and I only saw one group. I think they were in Japan. I could be wrong. But one group that believes that they photographed it. And it's not like a crisp, clear video where you see a puff and the rocket hit. It's this very grainy video where they see a little bit of extra light and they think they splashed something. So long story short, it turned out to be a lot more difficult to photograph than we thought. But the aftermath, now that that spot is in daylight, we can see the crater that it left.
And has anybody looked yet or done any analysis on that? The crater?
They're working on it. Yeah. They've released the pictures of it, but I haven't seen any analysis or spectral data quite yet of like what has changed in that spot.
It's Astronomy Today on Vox Pop. 800-348-2551 is the number. Email is voxpop@wamc.org. John is in Glenville. John, go ahead.
Yes, hi. I'll try to make this quick.
Well,
this is more of an observation. Because you were just talking about the meteor showers. A number of years ago, I was in the Navy, and I was on a Navy ship about 100 miles south of Hawaii. It was pitch black on the bridge. You couldn't see the hand in front of your face. And suddenly, it was as light as day.
Wow.
For about 3 to 5 seconds,
wow.
It was as if we were in the middle of the day. And then it went black again. And what happened was it must have been a big meteor coming down, burning up in the atmosphere. It looked like a spaceship coming down and burning up in the atmosphere, and then it disappeared to the south, beyond the horizon.
That's amazing.
I just thought I'd mention that because you were talking about that topic earlier. Thanks.
Thanks a lot. That's really interesting. I mean, how many times has that happened out in the deep ocean?
Yeah.
Where there were no islands or anything.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure a lot. You know, we ever so often get these like dash cam videos of the bolides, the really bright ones. But you're right. I mean, most of the time they pass over the ocean and pretty much nobody sees them.
Amazing. The Russian asteroid explosion, several years ago, was that connected to the Perseids or was it a different? It wasn't connected with, but timing-wise, it was right around the same time.
It might have been around the same time. Yeah. I don't think we'd ever really be able to tell, you know, if one was truly from the shower or if it came in at a different angle or something. But no, it's pretty rare to get those big ones that bright up the sky, and especially ones where we can actually like go collect the meteorite afterwards.
Right. But 3 to 5 seconds, that's a long time.
Yeah. That one must have been coming in real low and kind of slow in comparison. That's the only way I could think it would make it that long.
You'd think you'd hear some sort of sonic boom or something.
Mm-hmm.
Very interesting. Well, thanks for that one. Let's go to Keene, New Hampshire. Love New Hampshire. 800-348-2551. Edward's over in Keene. Edward, go ahead.
Yeah, hi, Ray. Hi, everybody. Hey, this is a dumb question from long ago in my past. I think I learned that the speed of light measures the same no matter which direction you're going in. So, for example, if you measure the speed of light from the sun, whether we're going towards the sun or away from it in our orbit, it's the same.
Mm-hmm.
So is that premise true? Or we start there?
Yes. I'm going to pass this to Julia since she just took her relativity.
Oh, we're going to test the student now, Edward.
Is
here we go.
Is it the same always?
Yes, the speed of light will be the same. The only different thing you might see, depending on whether you're moving toward or away from something, is there would be a change in frequency. From Doppler shift.
Yeah.
But the speed of light, yes, the speed itself would be the same.
Mm-hmm. I think you just answered the rest of my dumb question in that how do you account for blue shift if the speed of light is the same?
Yeah.
So you're telling me that although the speed of the waves or the photons, whatever you want to call it, is the same, the frequency shift.
Yeah. That's so interesting. And Edward, thank you for the call. How's the weather out in New Hampshire today?
Glorious.
Oh,
glorious.
That's a
blue sky everywhere.
Great state. I'll see you guys there eventually. Hey, he was talking about light and the and the Doppler shift. But you can hear this anytime a plane goes over or a siren drives by. Explain simply the Doppler shift and why it affects more than just light.
Well, we actually most commonly experience it with sound, even like when you're driving on the highway
anytime,
and you hear a car go by you. So that happens because, you know, when something emits sound or light, you know, you get this wave. But if it's moving toward you, then you kind of experience that wave squished, which increases the frequency.
And what is squishing?
It's just like the waves like getting closer together because it's coming toward you.
Yeah. But the frequency is not changing.
The frequency is changing.
The frequency is changing.
Yes, that's what's
As
changing,
it comes
like,
closer to
sound.
You, the frequency goes up?
Yes. And if something's moving away from you, then the space between the waves is going to increase.
Why, though? In other words, why does it, assuming the light doesn't know or mm-hmm. the sound doesn't know that I'm there, why is it as it gets closer to me, the frequency goes up? I don't understand. I'm a radio guy. Explain.
Well, because it's because the thing that's making the sound, that's moving toward you. It's all relative. So
it's
like
all relative.
It's all relative. Mm-hmm. So like if you're standing still and something's moving toward you, then you'll hear the increase in pitch. But if someone else is standing, you know, behind you and behind the moving source, then it'll be moving away from them, so they'll hear the decrease in pitch.
Mm-hmm. Your head ever spin in these classes that you take?
A little.
Okay, because it usually does for me in every astronomy yeah. show. The number here is 800-348-2551. Dr. Valerie Rapson and student Julia Busmeyer join us today. And let's go to Brian in Herkimer. Brian.
Hey, how are you?
Good. Welcome.
Thank you. So I know you were kind of poo-pooing the meteor shower.
Yeah, I'm a downer. I know it.
Did you see it better, Brian?
Well, no. We tried to go out last night, or I wanted to go out, and I got up around 2 o'clock, and it was just cloudy. Mm. And I got up a little bit later, and it was still kind of cloudy, clearing up a little bit, but still not worth it to get up and go look. So I was wondering, you know, how much longer is it going to go on? And, like, do they become less frequent as time goes on, like less bright? Does it always have to be at, like, 2 in the morning? Like, those are my questions.
No, those are great questions. So the peak was last night. That's why everybody said go outside last
right.
night. But the meteor showers generally last for a week or two at least. Because it depends on how wide the stream of particles is that the Earth is passing through. And for this one, it's pretty wide. So you'll be able to see it tonight and this weekend. And we say go out 2 in the morning because that's when the Earth is facing the direction that it's moving. So you're going to get hit yep. head on with the most particles. So the meteor shower should be best around 2 a.m. Mm. But if you go out at, you know, okay. 9 or 10 o'clock after dark, you still have a decent chance of seeing these things because they're coming from us at all different directions.
I did see one last week just out of the corner of my eye,
nice.
But it wasn't, you know, I don't know if it was a person or just a random whatever.
Yeah.
So
basically
like through the end of next week would be okay?
Yeah. I mean, I think if you try this weekend, that's your best chance. The farther away you get from the peak, the less you're going to see. I can't guarantee anything, but the sooner the better.
But you can also not guarantee that he won't see anything at any time. You could see a meteorite fly by or a meteor fly by any time.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Hey, Brian, thanks a lot. 800-348-2551 is the number. I should get my meteorite and meteor correctly on an astronomy show, and sometimes I screw it up. It's the way it is. Marta in Poughkeepsie. Marta, you're on.
Hey, Ray. Long time no talk to.
Hey, how are you?
Question for the experts.
Sure.
I've heard that whenever they launch a rocket from our planet, it tips the Earth slightly. You know, like that's what the axis is affected. And this is why they have to find spots that are like closer to the equator so that it doesn't disrupt too much as far as the way the Earth turns. Can people who know stuff expand?
So in other words, you don't want me to say anything. All right, let's go.
No, you know stuff.
No, not at all. Let's go to Valerie.
I mean, I have never heard that before. I don't think our rocket, while they're very powerful on human scales, I really don't think they're going to affect much how the Earth is turning. I mean, we're putting them towards the equator because that's where the Earth is relatively spinning as fast as it's going to spin. So you're basically giving the rocket a little bit of extra natural boost to get up in the atmosphere. And also it's convenient to launch them like over the ocean so that we don't hit anything if there's an accident. So there's a lot of reasons why we do it near the equator, but I don't think it's really going to affect the spin or the tilt of the Earth at all.
But we have heard of, I think, either massive earthquakes or volcanoes that have momentarily or somewhat perturb the spin, the rotation?
Yeah, I mean, there's probably some very small effect, you know, during these types of things, but nothing long-term. It's not like we're going to tilt so much that the seasons are going to change or anything like that. These would be, like, very, very minute changes.
All right, Marta, thank you so much. 800-348-2551 is our telephone number. The email is voxpop@wamc.org. Julia Busmeyer is a senior physics and astronomy student at SUNY Oneonta. Valerie Rapson is a professor of physics and astronomy at SUNY Oneonta. A lot of Oneonta going on today and a lot of astronomy. We'll grab one more call before the next break, and then we'll do it again. 800-348-2551 is the number. Chris is in Housatonic. Chris.
Yeah, Valerie and Judy, I got a question for you. Are the black holes that they study in the universe stronger than light? And secondly, the last question the person had gave me a thought that I was watching on TV, The Curse of the Bermuda Triangle. Do you think the meteorites have anything to do with the Alaskan and Bermuda Triangle?
Interesting.
Mm. And lastly, SR-71's travel outside of the space.
You saw what?
No, the reconnaissance plane, SR-71.
SR-71. Okay, very good. Well, we've covered these a few times, Chris, but... black holes more powerful than
I mean, I know nothing about the Bermuda Triangle, but black holes are pretty cool, and they manipulate space, which also means they are manipulating anything that travels through space.
Right.
So if you have light passing by a black hole, it will either be bent around it or potentially fall in towards the black hole. But it doesn't really change anything about it.
Is it what now, Chris?
Would it disappear the lightning?
Would it
disappear? We're good. The lightning will always be here on Earth because that's much closer to our planet.
All right, buddy. Hey, we got to take a break. 800-348-2551 is our number. It's Astronomy Today with Valerie Rapson and Julia Busmeyer. And you will be back to the phones in a moment. Thad Jones and the group doing Count One here on Vox Pop. 800-348-2551, the number. It's Astronomy Today with Valerie Rapson and Julia Busmeyer. Very quickly, before we jump back to the phones, and Karen in Hillsdale is next, there's some things we didn't even touch upon, and that is Betelgeuse. There was some discovery, or I don't know if it's a discovery or they've reanalyzed the data. But big news.
Yeah, the Betelgeuse is a binary.
Amazing.
Which is really cool. Now, unfortunately, we can't see that with our eyes. We're not going to see two stars there. But they've been thinking this was the case for a while because everybody has been watching it change in brightness over time and it wiggles a little bit.
Yeah.
But they finally were able to take a picture where they actually see the companion star. It's only about three times the mass of the sun, which is way smaller than Betelgeuse. But it's right next door. We have our first picture ever. And what they're going to do is image it again a year from now to make sure that the object is actually like orbiting, moving around Betelgeuse. And if it does, that's confirmation that it's got a companion.
That
it's
is
a binary.
So cool. And then you said right before we went on about a new globular cluster, which is perhaps shedding some light on dark matter.
Yeah, this is it's not a new globular cluster in our galaxy. This is a globular cluster, a big clump of stars in a faraway galaxy that seems to have been like slightly distorted and kind of torn apart. And it's really hard to see these because they're very faint. But we've detected one for the first time, and we think it's because dark matter is inside of this galaxy and it's basically tearing this globular cluster apart. And we're now able to map like where the dark matter is based on how this cluster has been disrupted. And it's like a second way of being able to see dark matter without actually being able to see dark matter.
Amazing. And, you know, you talked about globular clusters outside of this galaxy. We have all these Messier. Is it Messier or Messier?
Yeah. Messier, yeah.
Okay. Explain to us just briefly, and we'll go to Karen in less than a minute, what a globular cluster is, And how many are there in this galaxy, in the Milky Way?
Yeah, there's a whole bunch. We have like tens, like 50 or so probably documented. But they're just groups of tens of thousands of stars that are above and below the galaxy. And they form when the galaxy forms. So 10 billion years ago, the Milky Way collapses down. And as the galaxy is collapsing, it's forming some star clusters as it goes. And these star clusters are just remnants of the galaxy forming, and they always orbit around our own.
But wouldn't the stars be extinct by then, 10 billion years?
Some of them would be. The more massive ones that die really fast, they're long gone. But these globulars tend to be full of solar mass stars or stars that are even smaller. And by age dating these stars, that's how we know how old the Milky Way is and how old our galaxy really is.
And how sure are we of that age?
Well, pretty sure. I mean, okay, within like a billion or half a billion years. So,
okay.
I mean, that's really good precision for astronomy, though. Like, same order of magnitude, and you're good. So.
You know, that's a pretty wide... Using that, I'm very young and vital.
Of course.
It's pretty good. Let's go to Karen in Hillsdale. Karen, you're on.
Hi. Last summer, I went out. I think it was around the time of the Perseids. And I looked up, and all of a sudden... Moving northwest, there seemed to be, it wasn't like an arc of a shooting star, but it almost looked like a train of, you know, like a, with a wide trail, like an inch wide, with light moving across the sky.
That's interesting.
I had never seen anything like it.
Well, let's throw this to Julia. I have a theory, but you go first.
I would say you were probably looking at a trail of Starlink satellites. So that's SpaceX. They have these trains of satellites that kind of move all together. And it looks like, you know, a train of stars. They're not super bright, but definitely noticeable, just moving across the
ambling
sky.
Ambling along.
Yeah.
And
mm-hmm.
if it's soon after it was launched, they'll be very close together. As they continue around the Earth, they spread out. But, Karen, it is the coolest thing to see. And I know astronomers hate this because all the extra satellites
But it didn't look...
Go ahead.
It didn't look like points of light. It looked foamy.
Foamy? Well, I don't know.
I wonder, it's possible you were seeing some of these brighter satellites, but maybe through a little bit of haze. So, you know, you're kind of scattering the light between where the satellites are and you. So that could be what it was, because I wouldn't expect anything to be kind of streaking or foamy like that, unless it was a distant airplane.
Or a rocket launch. Yeah, it could have been a high-flying plane and maybe a contrail or something. Karen, it's fun to watch the sky.
Maybe. Okay, thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot. Appreciate it. Let's go to Richard in Rensselaer. Richard.
Hi, good afternoon. There's also a fuss about a planet train yesterday morning. And I know that Mercury moves kind of fast, but I was wondering really how much, and a couple of them you need a telescope to see anyway, so I don't think it's a big deal. But how different would it be like this morning and tomorrow morning than it was yesterday morning?
Yeah, the planet parades are always more hype than they're worth because the planets are always in a line in the sky. So everyone's like, oh, planet parade. But it's really just when many or all of the planets happen to be up in the same evening, they call it a planet parade.
It's still cool to see.
And it's cool to see them all, but you can't usually see them all at the same time. So I think like Venus and Jupiter are up in the early evening, but you have to wait until later. Like, you know, 2 or 3 a.m. to see the other planets. So tonight and tomorrow really isn't going to be that much different. So if you want to go out and check out the planets, the next time it's clear, it'll be good to see.
Richard, thanks a lot. You know those apps like Skywatch and Star, whatever it is? There are a couple different ones. And my wife's got them on her phone, and we're out back at night, and you can hold this thing to the ground, and it will show what's going on the other side.
Mm-hmm.
And there was the line of planets. It was so cool to see.
Yeah, they're really fun.
All right, let's go to Gabe, who's in Great Barrington. Gabe, go ahead, buddy.
Hey, Ray, how you doing? Love the show.
Thanks. Go ahead.
I have a quick question for you guys.
Yeah.
Since astronomers are about to have a lot more data about the universe, than we could ever possibly look at. I'm assuming we use AI to look into it. What happens when AI starts finding things in that data that humans didn't even know to look for, or how we know whether we've discovered something profound or just something we don't understand?
Yeah.
I love that question.
Yeah, no, I love it too. And I think AI is really going to be helpful in this respect of looking for patterns that we didn't think to look forward to. And, you know, astronomers have been kind of doing this for a long time. They've been processing data with algorithms and even having like hundreds of people do citizen science and all look at the same picture. And many new discoveries of things we've never seen before have actually been discovered by just random people who are helping us look at data. So, you know, as much as we talk about AI, I'm really kind of excited for what it's going to be able to do to process our data and help us find new things.
Great question. You want to follow
up? Such an exciting time.
Yeah, it is, man. Thank you for the call. So, let's see. Let's go to Lee, Massachusetts, and it's Brad's turn. Brad, go ahead.
Good afternoon. How are you all doing?
Pretty good. How are you?
Oh, fair to Midland.
All right.
I have a question. I have a rather nice Celestron 9-inch telescope.
Right.
But a few years ago, I moved to an area that's exceedingly light polluted. I understand that they do make a filter for your lenses that will filter out that light pollution. Are they effective?
They are to some extent. What they're basically doing is just blocking a lot of light in general, and they're designed to block specific wavelengths of light that come from the street lights and the housing lights. So you're going to stop light from coming through your telescope, so all of your objects are going to be a little dimmer. But you've got a 9-inch telescope, so that's pretty big to start with. So I think that would actually be fairly useful for you. It'll still be tricky to see some of like the fainter nebulas and stuff with that filter on, but worth it if you just want to do some planet observing and look at star clusters and things. I think it might be helpful.
Okay, cool. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Brad, thanks for the call. It's Astronomy Today with Valerie Rapson and Julia Busmeyer. 800-348-2551 is the number. We'll go to Florida, Massachusetts, and John. John, you're on.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
I just wanted to comment about an experience I had. I'm trying to nail down the year. It was either 2000 or 2001. And I think it was the Perseids. But my kids were real small, and my wife and I tried to wake them up because it was the most amazing display I'd ever seen. I literally saw probably 600-plus meteors that night.
Wow.
And nobody wanted to get up and come out and see them. But I went up on power lines with my four-wheel drive pickup truck. I got away from all the lights, which there's not many lights up here anyways. And I saw two came in emerald green, and they had yellow tails like you were grinding a piece of steel. And I could hear the crackle.
Okay.
And I know that it should take about 4 minutes for sound to travel that distance. But if there was any delay at all, it was less than a second. And it not only happened once, but twice.
Dude.
So I agree with Ray.
Yeah.
You can hear the crackle.
You know what I think it is, though? There are some reports, and I don't know how well investigated they have been, of people being able to hear a fizz from the Northern Lights. And I wonder if it's the same thing.
It could be. I'm going to have to look into it more. I mean, I believe that you guys heard this.
It's true.
I'm super curious to see what it is.
All right,
so
John.
Thanks for sharing.
Thanks for backing me up, man.
There's no doubt. There's no doubt about it. I definitely heard it. And one of the two emerald green ones came in and split into two, and both pieces maintained their emerald green and their yellow burning tails.
Now, John, thanks for the call. When we see green, I'll throw this to you, Julia. What does that tell us about what we're seeing?
When we see green, gosh, I'd have to brush up on my chemistry.
It's not copper, is it?
It might be. I think copper might be like a teal.
I don't remember.
I really have to brush up.
The nickel is maybe green.
Okay, maybe.
Yeah, and so I know in like comets, it's carbon monoxide and some oxygens too. Yeah, I don't know. They're all a little different.
I've seen a green one in daylight, which was really freaky. This was decades ago.
Yeah.
Right here around Albany. The number is 800-348-2551. Mark is in Bennington. Hello, Mark.
Yeah, hi. The James Webb Telescope seems to be able to, you know, penetrate very, very far back, looking at galaxies that may have formed maybe 2 billion years after the Big Bang. And my understanding is that these mature galaxies should not exist, that it should take much longer for them to form. Is there any information on that?
Love it.
Yeah, I've seen some of these. They've detected like spiral galaxies in these super distant images. And it's a major question, because you're exactly right. We expected, you know, all early galaxies should just look like blobs. They shouldn't have any structure, because as you said, it takes time for that structure to form. And they're trying to figure out how these galaxies have spirals, how they've apparently collided with other galaxies, and they're only like a billion years old or even less than that in some cases. So yeah, I saw the article recently, and it was a lot of really interesting stuff that even those studying it don't have an answer to yet.
If something like that is confirmed, does it say to you, a professional astronomer, hey, maybe some of our basic suppositions about the Big Bang are wrong?
Well, maybe not the Big Bang itself, but I would say more about the time frame that it takes for galaxies to form, and potentially how densely packed with galaxies our universe was at that time.
Hey, Mark, we're going to let you go there, but thank you for a good one. A couple of emails here. This one's from Zoe. All right, let you explain this one. Whither the bang, says the subject heading. On what day of the year and at what time of the day do the axis of the sun and Earth line up with the site of the Big Bang? Now I'm going to let you...
What? So the answer is always and never at the same time.
That's a great answer.
Because the Big Bang happened everywhere, right? So it's not like, you know, you can point to the center of the galaxy. You can point to certain locations, but you can't point to where the Big Bang happened, because it happened right here in the studio. It happened where everybody is sitting. It happened in every galaxy. And we're expanding from every point all the time. So there is no perfect alignment. There's no direction to look for the Big Bang. It's just happening right in front of you all the time.
It's still going on?
Yeah. Well, I mean, the expansion is still going on for sure.
Do we know if ever the universe will start falling back on itself? Have we proven that incorrect?
Not yet. We have the ideas so far point to a more perpetual continuation of the expansion, but we haven't 100% ruled out that there'll be a big crunch someday where we just squish back down and do it all over again.
Anne writes in, I have anxiety thinking about what humanity will do when the sun burns out. Can you say anything to make me feel better? And that's from Anne.
Oh. Well, the best answer I can give you is you definitely do not have to worry about that happening in your lifetime. It's going to be a long, long time. Honestly, I don't know if this will make you feel better or not, but I am not feeling very optimistic currently that humans will even still be around when we go red giant. So I don't know if anyone will have to worry about that necessarily.
Here's what scared me as a kid, and I understand that email, the premise of that email, having that anxiety. Here's what my concern was. Well, scientists haven't been around that long. What if they're wrong about the life cycle of this class of star?
I think we have too many examples of stars like ours that we have seen go through a long process. So I think we're fairly confident that, you know, the sun's not going to explode tomorrow all of a sudden.
This is from Greg. If everyone on the East Coast goes on the interstate in the morning and heads west, would the sun rise a little earlier that day in L.A.?
This sounds like a great physics problem that I'm going to put in a test in the future, right? It's like that train problem. If the train goes this way, when do they
meet? Yeah.
No, I think there's really not a lot that we can do as humans to, like, affect the rotation of the Earth in a measurable
way. What if
we
all jumped up and down? There's so many billions of us now. Same time.
Yeah, I'll have to do the math and figure this out, right? Like, how many people would it take to jump in the same spot at the same time to, like, nudge the Earth out of its orbit? That would be a fun physics problem.
Julia, are you regretting being on these shows over the summer?
This might be on your test later this year. No. So.
Well, all right, fair enough. I guess we're almost done here. Let's grab one more very quickly. Fred, you only have about 20 seconds. That's not a good start.
Yes,
oh, there you are. Go ahead.
Hello.
Very quickly, sir.
Okay, yeah. Very quick. Subtominous regions of black holes. What does that mean?
Subtominous? I don't even know.
I've heard that. So, no,
like
I know what black holes are. A lot of people don't.
Subatomic.
But a subatomic. Did I say it wrong?
I don't know.
Maybe. I mean, subatomic just means, like, you know, smaller than an atom. So they might be talking about, you know, the center of black holes are infinitely dense and small. So we can talk about how they are affecting things at subatomic levels. But I'm not sure if there's, like, a subatomic portion of a black hole, really.
Now, how can anything be infinitesimally small or dense?
Well, that's because black holes are weird and we don't fully understand them yet.
All right. Well, I'll leave it there. Valerie Rapson, if people want to find out more about the planetarium and stuff at SUNY Oneonta, how do they do that?
SUNY Oneonta's website has all the information.
Julia Busmeyer, good luck in the senior year.
Thank you.
Try to, you know, stay focused. It's almost
over. I'll do my best.
All right. Well, thanks for being here. Support comes from Harrington's Lumber Millwork on Building Supplies, offering personalized kitchen and bath design with craft-made vantage cabinetry, custom countertops, and tile, harringtons.com. All right, that's it for the show today. Thanks to Valerie Rapson and Julia Busmeyer for being here. Thank you for listening. Thanks for the emails. I have to look at the script, which I just put in the recycler. I forgot what's on tomorrow's show. Well, thanks to Susie Chetguy for screening the calls and Mike Bowen, our engineer. Now, listen, I'm Ray Graff. That's on the script. Tomorrow, it's a Food Friday. And you know what? I should have remembered this. It's cheese. We will have cheese with Mary Rizzo from The Cheese Traveler and Shalina Bridgham from Four Fat Fowl. It's going to be fun. It's cheese-tastic. We'll see you, too.